Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios and the EAA Chapter 84 podcast. I'm your host, David Weber. Finally, summer is here. The weather is good, so get out there and fly. Make that $100 hamburger flight to somewhere special, or take your someone special out to dinner in the San Juans. Whatever, just fly. This month we are talking to someone very special, well known around the Puget Sound, and I dare say the world. He was born and raised on the east side, makes his home in Snohomish on his private airstrip where he flies anything from Cessna 180s to Piper Cubs. Of course, I'm talking about Rocky Kyle. If there's a better example of an adventurous soul, well, then I haven't met one in my life. Rocky shares with us his memories of growing up in the east side Bellevue area, how things were in those days, stories of airports that have disappeared and people that were involved with them. We get to ride along as Rocky tells us about his adventures as a young man traveling in South America and the innovative things he needed to do to keep his travels moving forward during that time. Then Rocky takes us back to some more local stories, specifically centered around Harvey Field in Snohomish and the Shamrock Club. I know you're going to enjoy this interview with local legend Rocky Kyle. As usual, the podcast wraps up as I bring you the latest Chapter 84 news, including updates on meetings and events. Please, if you're enjoying these podcasts, I would encourage you to subscribe to the EAA Chapter 84 podcast. Doing so helps keep this podcast going, but more importantly, it will help you know when a new podcast is available. We'll be right back after a quick break. Well, welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios. I'm here today with a very honored guest, somebody I knew for quite some time before I knew who he was, if you follow me on that. My guest today is Rocky Kyle. Welcome to the studios, Rocky.
Thank you very much.
Let's jump into a little bit of your history here. Now, I know you grew up in the area. Tell our listeners where you grew up and tell us a little bit about your young childhood.
Well, I was born in Seattle in 1944, raised in Madison Park area till age 10, and then moved to the outlying community of Bellevue in 1955.
Where there was still an airport at the time.
Oh, right? Yeah. And then finished school in Bellevue, and by then the second floating bridge had come in and Bellevue had exploded, and I went off to live my life.
So now, did you go to Bellevue High School?
I did, yep.
And how big was Bellevue High School at the time?
Our class was about 300. I think there were maybe 1,200 in the school. I don't know. We were not a large class. The school is probably bigger now.
There's several high schools over there now. So
right.
Yeah.
There was only one high school. Lake Sammamish High School was built when I was in high school. The system was being overloaded a bit, and so it was smallish. There was only one traffic light in Bellevue at the time. So it was pretty slow. One two-story building. That was pretty slow.
I would imagine. Now you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have a brother and two sisters, right?
Would you mind giving their names out?
Yeah, my brother is Sandy Kyle. We live next door to each other. And my sister Tammy lives in L.A. And my younger sister Tisha lives in Denmark.
Denmark?
Raised her family in Denmark.
Wow, that's interesting. What was mom and dad doing during your youth?
My dad was disabled. He had a very serious heart condition, and mm-hmm. in 1950, when he was stricken, there was not much choice of heart surgery or whatever. You were supposed to take it easy the rest of your life, and he was really handicapped with that problem. And my mother worked. She was a social worker, worked for King County for a full career. So,
all along doing social work. So dad didn't do much work at all at that time?
No, he had done some, a little bit of dabbling in flying in the 20s, and then worked for a bank. I think he had a car dealership for a while, and then he became quite ill. So he lived, a pretty quiet life.
Was he educated at all?
Yeah, he went to the University of Washington and studied political science and used it, I suppose, in his banking career, if you could call it that.
And mom, she educated?
Yeah, she went to Mount Holyoke and Columbia, the typical education at the time. You know.
Pretty straight down the middle kind of education. Huh?
Yeah.
Now, what about your brother? What did he end up doing?
He went in the Navy. He was a hands-on mechanic type, and he spent his career as a bulldozer mechanic.
And, wow.
Yeah.
Now, your brother's name is Sandy.
Right.
Everybody calls you Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
Not your given name.
Right.
How did the name Rocky come about?
A family joke. That's the most likely story. I don't know the true answer.
Sand and rock.
Yeah, I mean.
And you have no recollection how that came about?
No, none. No, I've been Rocky since my first recollection, so.
And nobody in the family will take claim to this?
No, my sisters both have nicknames also, but well, I think it was just part of the culture. Yeah, Mariana became Tammy and Patricia became Tisha. That's much more logical.
Yeah, much more logical. So you you get out of high school, and how do you continue on with...
I went to a small liberal arts college, Whitman, in Walla Walla, and then went to graduate school at the University of Arizona, studied physics, and went to work for Boeing. A couple of years before they turned the lights out.
What year was this that you went to work at Boeing?
68. Yeah, worked at the Missile and Information Systems Center in the Aerospace Center at Kent.
Oh, wow. We
were doing guidance systems for the Minuteman and the SRAM missile.
So what was the engineering like at those days? Was it slide rule?
It was. In fact, we had to get permission to use a computer down the hall that ran BASIC and paper tape to store your program.
What were you doing with that computer?
We were modeling the spectral signature of parts of the upper stage rocket casing, trying to turn them into decoys, cheap decoys, on a reentry weapon.
Oh, okay.
You'd like to protect the weapon. And so you surround it with decoys, and it's very difficult to remove
it. As it would come back in, you would shred these decoys out that...
Right, or if you're going to carry a kilogram of material into orbit, it's very expensive.
Right.
You might as well do what you can with it. So surround yourself, cut it into parts that could look like a reentry vehicle in certain parts of the spectrum. You can't make it perfect, but you might improve your chances of success.
Did you ever get to test this?
Only on paper.
Only on paper.
Right.
Nothing ever happened. So what else did you do with this at Boeing in the beginning?
It was only 2 years.
Okay.
And in fact, shortly after I joined, they basically told us, when this job you're working on is over, we don't have a plan B.
This is when the lights were going out in
Seattle with Boeing.
Right.
They had 70,000 laid off. And so I made a few inquiries, and Boeing treated me very well. I mean, literally one comment about interesting to consider a job here or there, and there'd be airline tickets on my desk Monday morning to
go interview.
They were trying so hard, and the choices were pretty thin. There was a significant recession around the country. So I bought a trade van, a Volkswagen commercial van used, and made it into a camper and drove it to Argentina.
Yeah. Were there any women in your life at this time?
Not really, no.
Just
Bill Jepson came along with me, and we started he'd come back from Vietnam and finished his degree at the U and wanted an adventure, and I delayed until my sister got married in Denmark, and then headed for South America.
And, well, tell us about that. How did that trip go?
Well, we made it to Colombia. The big challenge then and now is to get across from Panama to Colombia. There's no road through I think that's partly political. And it's probably a good thing. So when we got to Venezuela, and then back, really in Venezuela, my Bill had met some people and went off on a side adventure. And a few months later, I met him in Quito, and he by then had connected up with an American doing a very big land development project in Quito. So he stayed for 10 years in Quito working on that. And I continued on, and 2.5 years later saw him coming home. And in fact, I renewed acquaintance, and we traded stories, and I came home and went to work for another company.
So now during your travel down South America, did you ever have any engine problems, any breakdowns?
Yeah, a couple of times. You know, the Volkswagens are not overly built.
Well, what do you do there? I mean, it's not like you have Amazon and you can order a part.
I had a valve head break off in Caracas, but they're made in Brazil, and I think they were even made in Venezuela at that time. This is 1970.
Okay.
And I was able to get it repaired at a shop. And then I had one other significant failure in Argentina. Again, a valve head broke off. Anybody who knows Volkswagens knows the number three cylinder is always the tender one behind the oil cooler.
Behind the oil cooler.
And so I hung around with some wonderful pilot fellows I had met a few weeks before.
Okay.
And they had never seen a Volkswagen engine up close because Argentina deals more with Italy than Germany for historical reasons. So Volkswagen parts were very difficult to get in Argentina, but one of the local people, the pilot of the father of a crop duster pilot at this little airport, took it on as a challenge to find a replacement cylinder and piston for this damaged part of the engine. And in Paraguay, the German influence is strong, parts are available, and he reached out. And this is before, this is 1971. So communication is by letter, by phone, telegraph, and all.
Yeah.
And he came up with parts and ordered them. I paid him for them, but he did all the legwork, and it was just wonderful. And the airport owner, an Italian fellow, was fascinated to take apart this, looks like a Lycoming, I mean, basically.
Right.
Yeah. So it was all
boxer engine,
old
that,
stuff for him.
Yeah.
And he was intrigued to see. And a good part of that story is that when the engine failed, the rod was bent probably 30 degrees. It pushed the piston out through the side of the cylinder. That's not unusual for a valve failure on a VW. And I thought, there's no way in this green earth that we're going to save, probably not save the crank, and certainly not the rod. The piston is pieces. In the town of Coronel Dorrego, where I was, I had gone back to him because it was the last place I visited, and they had a nice shop, and they were friendly, and I was going to be a while fixing this problem.
Did you limp the...
I hired, there was a, they call it a mosquitero, it's a... The truck we see carrying new cars, going back empty. And I flagged him down, and he said, sure, for $100, I'll take you wherever you want to go. So, and the folks in Dorrego said, we have a nice machine shop in Dorrego. It's a very productive agricultural area in the Pampas of Argentina.
Okay.
This is not Patagonia. I mean, it's a wonderful farming area, big tractors. Eight tires, four-wheel drive, monster.
So sophisticated.
High productivity, right?
Right.
And the engines require caressing and shops that know what they're doing.
Right.
And it turned out there was a shop in town when the proprietor, Pepe Colantonio, said, oh, we have Magnaflu. What's Magnaflu? No problem. And, well, it's Magnaflux is what it is. And when we took the rod to the shop where this Dutchman did all this heavy maintenance on expensive equipment, he said, oh, sure, we can do that. And he looked at the rod, and he x-rayed it, and he said, it's not cracked. It's been bent, but I can straighten it. And he put it in a press, And he put it in the optical comparator, the 50X optical comparator with a half meter screen. And, you know, here I am wondering if he's got a good hammer. He's way beyond that. He brought it right into spec and said, here's your parts. And the crank was fine, checked it, put it all back together with the new piston and new cylinder. And I drove it another 2 years and put another 40,000 miles on it. And it was running when I left it.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So that was the other.
Do you remember what he charged you to do all this?
I don't know. I think I had acquired a shotgun and a pistol. I came through on this adventure. I came from Colombia to Venezuela, back to Colombia. There was no road through to Brazil. And then down the west coast, through the Andes, from Bolivia, I went east through the jungle and took the bus on a small barge to the Brazilian frontier, and then drove out through western Brazil, Rondônia, Mato Grosso. It was a 2,000 mile dirt road. And after that, went down the east coast through Brazil and Argentina, and that's where the engine failure occurred, and then came back to the west coast, Chile, and back up the home. I left the bus in with Bill in Quito. But so it was a...
And you've never seen it since?
No. He had it for, another 5 years or so. And I think it fell into disrepair.
And how old were you when all this was going on?
I was 26.
Oh.
20, it would be 70, it would be 26, 27. Yeah.
So just enjoying life at 26, 27. Now, any aviation started at this point yet?
I had learned to fly as a member of the Boeing Employees Flying Club.
Oh, while you were at Boeing.
Yeah. In the 2 years I was at Boeing.
It's a great club.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was wonderful. I get to fly a bunch of different airplanes, and there was a great introduction. And then at the end of that session, John Trode and Bill Jepson and I bought a Luscom together and flew that for 5 or 6 years. So the aviation bug was already there.
So you actually got your pilot's license
in 68.
While you were...
Right. After work at Boeing, I'd go to the Boeing Employees Flying Club and take lessons.
And was that out of Renton?
It was at Bellevue. At Boeing Field.
Boeing Field,
They were talking about opening an office at Renton, and I think that's probably their main activity now. I don't know.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. They had about 30 airplanes. They had a 206. They had a... they were getting a 210. They didn't have it at the time. They got us a Sabria while I was a member. But they were a very active club. Yeah. It was a great way to get access to good instructors, and they took care of all the maintenance, and it was fun. Yeah.
Okay. So now you touched on a bit of an interesting person in my life, John Trode, who, if anybody doesn't know, is the owner of Dynon Avionics, and I've been working for Dynon. So I got a little bit interest in what your relationship was with John. Now, you grew up with John?
Yeah. I met Bill Jepson, the third of the triangle here, in elementary school. And then when we went to junior high school, I think that's where I first met John. And we crossed paths all through high school and then lost touch a bit when we went off to school. Regained contact with the flying. Bill was actually the one of us that was much more experienced. He had worked at Bellevue Airport and flown airplanes in and out for sales and delivery and stuff like that. And John and I learned at that time. I think John might have taken lessons in California. I'm not sure. You'll have to get that from him. But the three of us were partners on that Luscom, and we kept it at Bellevue for a while, and then at Boeing Field for a while. And then I left town. I kept my partnership, but John and another fellow, I don't remember his name, Bruce Milne, I think. He was in the partnership for a while. But
so you had three or four of you in the partnership?
Three. I bought Bill's portion.
Okay.
And I think I ended up buying Bruce Milne's. I'm not sure how that went.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bill sold his to Bruce, and I bought Bruce's out. I think that's what happened. Yeah.
And you kept it at Bellevue?
Yeah, Bellevue for a while, and then Boeing Field for a while also.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Was there any good adventures with that airplane that you care to tell us about?
Bill flew it to Mexico. That's a long ways in Alaska.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I learned a lot in it.
That thing cruises at, what, 80 knots?
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah. Faster than a Cub. Yeah. Wonderful airplane. Wonderful airplane. Yeah.
Did you have any good adventures in that airplane?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Camping, Stehekin, around the Northwest. Went to Walla Walla a couple of times, you know. For a new pilot, that was a nice adventure.
Were you just flying solo at this time?
Yeah, my brother came with me on a couple of these. Took friends for, you know, little adventures down to Round Mount Rainier and Ranger
Creek. So what was it like flying back then compared to today? Was it, you know, give me a little bit of a comparison in your thoughts.
Well, there was
different?
There was no Class Bravo airspace. That came after a tragedy in Southern California. The rules were probably simpler. I wasn't IFR rated at that time, and probably should have been. You know, the temptation was to push it a bit, but I was never a commercial pilot, just P-patch flying.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you, what about the airports? Were there any? I know Bellevue has closed.
Right.
What
right.
else around here that you remember?
Oh, gosh. There were...
Martha Lake is closed.
That's right. We used to go in there, and that wasn't so many years ago that was
right.
closed, right?
Right.
My first flight was at, I think it was called Lake Arrow. It was, I don't know the name, Lake Shore. It was on the south side of I-90 where Newport Shores is today. The canals cut in to make waterfront for home sites. That wasn't there. It was kind of a swampy area.
Uh-huh.
And there was a little airstrip north-south oriented.
On just grass?
Yeah. Yeah. And I have vague recollections of my dad taking my brother and I out there, and a friend of his had an airplane. I don't even remember what type. But as a little kid.
Now, what about the one out by Issaquah that...
Yep, by the Pickering farm, right? That was mainly gliders, and I flew in there a number of times, but it was mainly for glider activity.
Did they do any parachuting out there? Or was
a little bit.
Okay.
A little bit. There was one at Cedar Grove,
uh-huh.
What is now the Northwest Landfill site. If you use your imagination, you can still sort of see where some of the features line up. It was an east-west runway through a gravel pit area. The instructors would take you out there for emergency landing practice and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. grass strips back then were probably a little bit more prevalent than they are today.
Yeah.
Today you almost have to, like, search for a good grass strip.
Right, right. It's kind of a shame. Even Harvey's is slow to take the X off.
You know, right.
They're very careful with the soft ground.
Yeah, and I like flying my 140 out of that grass strip. I do that. It's just grass to me is so much more forgiving and fun.
It is.
That kind of thing. So what was the next plane after that?
I rented for a number of years. And from 73, when I came back from South America,
mm-hmm.
through about 78 or 9, I was renting out of a little operation at Boeing Field, Flerco. A university professor and a couple of other aviation types were leasing a 172 and a 150 to this small group. And before internet, you just phone into an answering service and they would take down your reservation request. And you had an account with them. It was kind of no front desk rental, airplane rental business. It worked okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's fine. And I could see the light that renting was not preferred.
Right.
I wanted to own something. So about that time, my brother and I were talking about finding a place to have an airstrip. And we did work that problem. And we, about the time we bought the property, I came across an ad for a 180 and bought it. And the rest is history.
The rest is history.
Right, right.
So now where is this the strip that...
We're halfway between Woodinville and Monroe.
Okay.
Near the Highway 522.
And what was it like trying to get an airport in there, get a runway, I should say?
It's a funny story. We started out going through the permit process, and when we reached the point of declaring our intent, the county fellow said, well, if this is a commercial activity, then you have to go through all these steps. And I said, no, it's not commercial. It's just private use. And he said, well, you don't need to go through this complicated process. Really? Oh, well, what do we do? Well, you make sure you don't bother your neighbors and just build it.
No.
Fly out of it, you know. So we did.
And what year was this?
In 1977. Yeah.
Well, so we, I guess I could see that.
We pulled in our horns and just said, let's keep a low profile. And I've never earned a dollar in rent or tie down or anything. And I'm squeaky clean on commercial, non-commercial. And we try to think about our neighbors from a noise point of view.
And you've never had any problems?
No. No. The only complaint I've ever had was from a fellow a mile away who was a pilot. And when I said I didn't want to have a customer keep an airplane there, he wanted to keep an airplane there, then he threatened to make problems for me. So oddly enough, another pilot was the only problem, and it never materialized.
No. So now did you actually have to cut the strip down the trees and all that stuff?
No. The property had been logged two years before we bought the property.
Okay.
And there was a logging road down the ridge where the runway is now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it had a few swales and bends in it, but we just straightened it. I don't think we made a cut deeper than a foot anywhere.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just, it's kind of down a hill and there's a corner at the end. And
so now how many airplanes do you have on the property now?
There are four.
Okay.
Right.
Your brother keeps?
He keeps a 150 there.
Okay.
And through life, we've ended up with three. Yeah.
So you've got a Cub.
Yeah. I rebuilt a Cub after getting the 180. Then an old timer at Harvey Field, Mac McGuire, approached me at the old Harvey Cornfeet and mm-hmm. said, you know, I've got a Cub in pieces in a barn. Would you be interested? And I said, of course. and so I bought his Cub and rebuilt it. And then my wife learned to fly. The fellow I used to report to at Boeing, my supervisor, Steve Gross, was an instructor as a hobby. He was a Navy instructor during the war. And he had a couple of 150s on leaseback to that same company in Boeing Field.
Okay.
And when he retired, he got out of that business, sold the 150s, and he offered one to Annette for sale. And she had just gotten her license under his guidance, and that was her baby. So we've had that airplane now for 38 years.
Well, since you bring up Annette, let's talk a little bit. How did you two meet? How'd that whole thing go on?
Well, my sister was a foreign exchange student from college and in Denmark for a number of months.
Okay.
And when there, she stayed with Annette's family, and they were trying to get Annette to learn English, so they would invite foreign exchange students to live with them in Copenhagen. And when my sister fell in love with a Danish fellow, he came to Bellevue to marry my sister, and Annette came to celebrate the wedding. And I met Annette at my sister's wedding in Bellevue.
That's a great story.
Yeah. And then 5 years later, we married, and she's been married now for, 45 years?
And so she just decided to get involved.
47 years.
47.
Yeah.
Hey, you better get that number right.
Yeah, right.
So did she have an interest in aviation before, or?
Not really. Her father flew for Hitler And we had a lot of fun together. But she followed the dream here. Mm-hmm. And it was never a passion for her, but she more than participated. I mean, she has made many flights. Yeah. Well, 38 years worth. Yeah.
Yeah. 38 years and still going strong.
Well, she's kind of backed away from it. It doesn't have the draw.
Really?
That's okay. You know, she paid her dues.
Well,
I don't complain.
No. And yeah. She doesn't tell you to sell anything? Or when
no,
you tell
no.
her, she probably tells you to go fly, right?
No, she got her float rating in the Cub, and she is very comfortable in the 150, and been there, done that, and I respect that. That's fine.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so it's probably time to get rid of the 150. It's a wonderful airplane. It's just the world's most perfect trainer. I can't imagine a better combination of features, you know.
Simple to fly, simple to operate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Everything
it just doesn't do anything spectacular, but it's so trustworthy. It's
yeah,
they're just tough. And, yeah. So
all right, so let's jump back into career a little bit now. So you get dismissed at Boeing. You go travel for a bit, and then you got to come back and start doing something for
right.
a living.
In fact, Boeing offered me a job when I came back. And,
really?
And I. The group was still there, and they were building back the pieces, and I took a chance. Another friend had gone to work for a controls company, Opcon, up in Everett, a brand new startup.
Okay.
And I was employee number 6 to start there, and I thought, well, I saw life in the fast lane, part of a big company, and uh-huh. I thought I'd like to try something small. So I declined the offer at Boeing and accepted the offer at Opcon, and I was there 15 years.
Oh, my gosh.
It was a wonderful experience.
And what did you do there?
I was a physicist working for this controls company. They were doing automation equipment, a little bit of image recognition, lots of simple electric eye applications. There's some subchapters to that. You don't need to worry about, but optics is used for controlling equipment, and it's very effective. And in some applications, it works very well. In others, you have to recognize the limits, and you know if the atmosphere is opaque or steamy or full
right.
of dust, and you know you use the tool properly.
Yeah.
And we did some interesting projects. They got their start in the wood processing industry, sawmills and stuff like that, but then they branched off into interesting control problems for automation.
Yeah. Are they still around?
They were purchased by Eaton,
oh.
a big company,
yeah.
and their product has morphed over the years. I haven't even kept up. I go to the old employees reunions once in a while, and there is a form of Opcon still around. You know, there will always be a need for sensors and switches and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after Opcon, 15 years there?
Yeah, well, at about year 10, then John and Bill and I joined forces. John was in a big project needing a drafting plotter for use with a CAD system. And he challenged Bill and me mm-hmm. to join to make a plotter. And we did. And we built plotters for use with AutoCAD and other CAD systems for a number of years, for it must have been about 10 or 12 years.
So you started a company?
Yeah, started a company.
What was the name of the company?
Ioline.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think they still exist in some form. They've morphed into vinyl cutting. In fact, the EAA chapter at Snohomish has a vinyl cutter
mm-hmm.
that is direct competition for some of the products that Ioline built. Ioline was never 100% into vinyl cutting. They were doing drafting plotters with some vinyl cutting capability. And then I think the new owners, when we got out of it, the new owners grew that part of the business. I didn't stay involved at all.
So this was Bill, you, and John all owning the company? And
that's right. And that's right.
Worked that. Mm-hmm. And
John provided all the technical expertise and a bunch of money.
Okay.
And Bill and I put sweat equity into it. And we made a low-end, very cost-effective plotter. You look around at Dynon and you'll see one out in the storeroom, an old one.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was kind of a big project for, and it grew to a nice product.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So where did you end up after, you know, at the end of your career or I guess you really haven't even retired.
Well, I retired out of the plotter project. And then I concentrated on raising my family and working around the house. My wife and I built our own house. We bought a kit and built it on the airstrip.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And that's been a real pleasure.
Does it just show up on the back of a truck bed?
It was made in Maltby, near where I live.
Okay.
And I borrowed a truck and a flatbed and brought the pieces over, and they were all numbered, and we had a big party and put them together. And like a Lincoln log. Yeah, International Homes. I'd do it again. That was nice.
Wow. And so you put all the labor into it.
Yeah. Annette and I and her parents, we put up the walls, and then her parents went back to Denmark. They'd come every year for a visit.
Okay.
Annette and I spent the next 2 years finishing the house, putting up sheetrock and wiring and plumbing and that kind of thing.
Right? Okay.
That's the house I live in now. I've been in the same house for 45 years.
Wow. So jumping into a little bit of the EAA story, kind of what your involvement around the area with local aviation, some clubs, that kind of stuff, where did you start your membership with that?
Well, I hung around Harvey a bit,
okay.
And there used to be a service club at Harvey called the Shamrock Flying Club. It goes way back before my time.
I think
time.
They did the original Wind Tee, did they not?
They did.
Yeah.
And I believe the Shamrock Club might have been involved in doing some work for patrol at the end of World War II. I remember Eldon Harvey.
Okay.
Candy's father-in-law from her first husband who died, he told stories about landing down on Marine View Drive by the waterfront north of the Navy base.
Oh, really?
There was a big marshalling yard down there, and they would, I'm not actually sure where this Shamrock Flying Club started, but let's say it was in the late 40s.
Okay.
By 68 or so, it was in full swing. We were involved quite heavily from maybe 75 till 85, 80. And by then it had lost its polish. But their main mission was to spruce up the airport, handle the Harvey Corn Feed, which used to be a big event.
Yeah, I've actually gone to two of those. But
right.
Yeah.
That every year that was a big deal. And Eldon would plant corn, we would harvest it by hand, and then cook it so that people could have hot buttered corn, and he didn't charge anything. And it ran very well for a number of years. The rumor was that their insurance company found out that they were doing this with a fly-in and a car show and all this. And they charged them a premium, and they had to start charging to pay that insurance adder. I was never part of that decision process. The Shamrock Flying Club, we would have meetings once a month and do things around the airport. And I believe long before I joined Shamrock, some of the locals built the Wind Tee, and I think it may be the same Wind Tee. Been rebuilt a couple of times, that was Phil Craig.
EA Chapter 84, we rebuilt that.
I'm not surprised, and a good friend.
I remember looking at peeling off the inside and seeing the shamrock.
Oh, sure. I wouldn't be surprised. The fellow that comes to mind to me is Phil Crape. He and several others were very active around Harvey Field for many years before we began hanging around. And he was a machinist, mechanic type. Mm-hmm. And he often said to me that he and a couple of his friends built the frame and installed it and made it usable. And over the years, it's been a standard.
Oh, yeah. The thing's very well done inside.
Yeah. That's Phil. That was all before my time.
Wow. Right. So who else was involved in this Shamrock Club that you remember?
Oh, Tom Barr, the mechanic that the Dynon operation at Harvey uses the hangar that was his workshop. Yep. He and Lee Levitt had a...
Were those the helicopter guys?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. He did the search and rescue for Snohomish County for many years. They would bring surplus helicopters in, get them airworthy, and then use them for search and rescue. And he was he's been a big part of my life. He was my mentor starting out with the 180. He did the pre-buy and he did the checkout for learning how to fly it. He still does the annuals.
He's
87 years old. So
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Yeah, he lives in Idaho, and he comes over for the annual inspections, and he does a few for others. So he's heavily retired, if you will.
But yeah,
he knows the airplane
so
like
well.
The back of his hand. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So
he can look at things and just have it. So Shamrock Club was part of Snohomish history, mm-hmm. and originally EA Chapter 84 was here at Everett.
Okay,
and then moved down to. To Harvey.
Did they make that move?
Oh, that had to be, I would imagine, probably sometime around the late 70s.
Okay.
And when I first joined it, it wasn't until the late 90s that I was part of the chapter. And we were at the library, at the PUD building in Snohomish,
sure.
and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But if you look at all of our old symbols and flags and stuff like that, a lot of that's Everett. And our original charter was here at Payne Field.
Right.
They would meet at the Restoration Center right over here.
Sure.
Kind of a thing. So, a lot of history there, and I think a lot of intermingling between the areas. That's why it's so interesting to listen to this Shamrock Club.
Right.
I didn't realize it was so involved down at Harvey.
Yeah, they were the main source for cheap labor at the picnic. That was their main purpose to be. And then I think they did other... We had some nice flyouts. We went up to Victoria when Annette and I were more uh-huh. heavily involved. We actually got 7 or 8 airplanes and went into Victoria and spent the night. And went to the Craig Derrick Castle and the Empress Hotel and, the typical touristy stuff.
Right.
So it was kind of fun, adventure to go international. Can see it from the pattern.
Let's talk a little bit about your airplanes that you've owned throughout the years and what your favorite one was and what one you didn't like and why and that kind of stuff. What was your most favorite airplane?
Oh, I think the 180 has to be the top. Yeah, the Cub is a hoot, to be sure. But for general capability, long legs, longer legs, and a wonderful, simple, trustworthy airplane. I think the 180 has to take the prize.
Is that because of its baggage capability or just its all-around mission?
Just all around. I mean, it's so simple.
Uh-huh.
It's manual flaps and very straightforward. It does exactly what you ask it to do.
Uh-huh.
It's not, I don't think there are any bad habits. It's just a wonderful airplane.
So talk me through an approach into your place. How do you approach that with the 180?
Well, this one has a Robertson Stoll conversion that the government put on. It used to be a forest fire observer airplane in New Mexico.
Okay.
Before I bought it. And I've owned it since 1979. 78, 79, I'd have to look back. The stall speed is well under 50 miles an hour.
That's impressive.
Yeah, it's a wonderful conversion. They're not worth doing today because there are other choices, but for that period, it was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I approach 1,000 foot above the ground for the downwind, and I make sure that I'm on glide path for the final leg. There's a bit of a turn when you're close to the ground.
Required. So you're always heading south then on your
always
boat?
Land south. Yeah, okay. Right. And there's a 10 or 15 degree heading change after you go through a notch in some trees, and I think the fellow Bob Joppa, a University of Washington aeronautical engineering professor, designed a simple VASI equivalent for Harvey Field, and it lived there for a long time. It was two posts with a light bar on each post, and then a light bar on the ground 50 feet further down the runway. And when you see that from the approach, all three bars line up, you're on glide path.
And now, are they lit?
These were.
Okay.
At Harvey.
At Harvey, that's right. But yours aren't.
Well, I put lights on mine also, but I didn't do it with a box. I just put a light bulb up there.
Okay.
So that can tell you if you're on glide path. And that's the main goal, is to be on glide path, on speed. And because it's uphill at home, and there are 80-foot trees at the uphill end, there's really no go-around option. I mean, in a really high-performance airplane, you can do it. But in a 172 or a 150, it's impossible. This is not going to happen. So the decision whether you're on glide path, whether your energy management is acceptable, that decision is easy to make a quarter mile, maybe even half a mile from the end of the runway. And that's a big advantage, huge advantage, if you're willing to look at the data.
So if you look there and you see that the numbers aren't right,
yeah,
go around.
Go around. There's no heroics here. It's not going to end well if you try to...
Has anybody not ended well?
No, we've never had a problem.
I didn't think so. You told me that you've never had a problem.
No, and I don't want one, no.
Matter of fact, you were telling me once about... I wish I could remember exactly how this went. Something about pushing the stick forward in order to get... Talk me through that.
Well, if you're... There's an interesting question for a bull session in flying. If you come to a point on a glide path where you are clearly too high, and you wonder if the airplane can generate a really steep descent without gaining too much speed, then ask the question, how much power would it take to fly that path the other direction? In other words, if you're in a 150 and 1,000 feet above the ground, and maybe 3,000 feet from the touchdown spot, that's a pretty steep glide path angle.
Okay.
If you put on full flaps and chop the power, no slips for this discussion.
Okay.
And watch your glide path and fly the approach at the top of the white arc for that aircraft.
Okay.
So you don't hurt the airplane. You'll generate a pretty steep glide path, but you'll be going at the top of the white arc when you get close to the ground. Now, fly in ground effect, again, still full flaps, and let it decelerate until you touch, and then do a normal rollout. Compare that end point of the rollout with the opposite alternative to fly at 1.1, 1.2 stall.
Okay.
Very slow, and let it mush down. No power, full flaps, no slips, same basic conditions, but...
So high angle of attack, just...
Just mushing down.
Okay.
And compare the distance to stop with, you know...
Right.
Normal rollout. And in some airplanes, you'll see it's remarkably better to use full flaps and high speed because you're dissipating so much energy. That's where the interesting discussion starts. How much energy would it take in a 150 to climb at full flaps at 80 miles an hour, wide arc.
Okay.
And it's going to take, to duplicate that flight path in reverse with a big motor would take 800 horsepower. Right?
A 150 doesn't have an 800 horsepower engine.
That's the energy you are dissipating when you go down the glide path.
I gotcha.
It's the same in reverse. It's the same airplane flying the same path in the opposite direction. You're letting gravity be your motor. You're taking advantage of this tremendous drag. And the drag goes up as the cube of the speed. So it's a wonderful way to get rid of energy.
So now how do you apply this going into your place?
Okay. If you're even close to being on glide path, the energy management problem is solved, right?
Well, you're on glide path.
You're on glide path and you're on speed.
Right.
So the discussion that you're referring to is, as a sidebar on this topic, the problem we have at home, it's a one-way strip.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have a tailwind, which we often do in the summer, quartering tailwind, we have a typical northwesterly of 10 or 15 knots.
Okay.
And when we come down below the treetop, there's quite a bit of wind shear because this 10 or 15 knot wind at above the treetops goes to almost zero below the treetops because they block the wind. Well, now the discussion gets a little more interesting. What happens to that glide path or your energy management problem when you move from a tailwind condition to no tailwind condition? You drop down below the treetops. You have this wind shear.
That's right. Now I remember where you're going with this.
Okay, now what do you do to your glide path to take into account this change you know is coming?
You do something that you wouldn't think you would do.
Correct. Well, when you have a headwind that goes away, landing upwind, like we like to do, you better add a little bit of speed because you know you're going to lose airspeed when you get behind the shelter of the trees. When you have a tailwind on landing, you have exactly the opposite. You're going to be dropped into still air. So you will suddenly find a 10 or 5 or 10 knot increase in airspeed when you move out of this tailwind zone into a no tailwind zone. You better accommodate that on a short airstrip.
Oh, yeah.
So what I recommend is that you push over right at the top of the trees.
Actually, push the stick forward.
Steep. Several things happen. You penetrate the shear zone quickly. The control authority gets back where it should be. If you're flying at 1.1 stall, you don't have very good control authority. The stick is kind of mushy.
Right.
If you unload the wing, now the ailerons will give you plenty of roll control. The elevator gives you plenty of pitch control because the alpha is low. When you have this high alpha, you don't have... You know, the system doesn't have much control authority.
No.
So right when you want to penetrate this shear zone, lower the alpha. Push over. The energy management problem is solved as long as you stay off the throttle. The only way you can add energy to the system
is to go throttle.
Just add throttle.
Yeah.
Don't touch the throttle. Push over. You'll gain a little bit of speed, but not much. The energy, you know the energy was right because you were on glide path and on speed a few minutes, you know, a few seconds before this. And it really works well.
I can see
that's
how that...
That's the story I was... and it's... That's the result of a lot of trial.
And
some high pucker factor sometimes, you know.
Yeah. Well, when you were telling me that the first time, that's exactly what it was. I was... quite amazed at that you would actually push that stick forward. But after listening to it, it makes sense.
Well, think about the energy management. Think about the process as an energy management problem.
And that is a way to approach almost any landing. It's energy management.
Correct. So if you go through a checkpoint mm-hmm. 1,000 feet above the ground and 3,000 feet from the threshold, and you say, okay, from this point on, I'm in the safe zone. I'm not risking anything.
Right.
Now, whether you trade altitude for speed, you're trading, right? Mm-hmm. You're not adding any energy.
No.
Right?
No. It's physics. That's just physics. That's right. Right there.
The last part of that is to keep in mind that if you do want to dump a little bit of energy, do it at high speed. It's so much more effective. Put the flaps down, get into a high drag configuration, and let the speed build up. Now you are dumping a lot of energy.
Right.
And that's valuable. Don't worry about gaining a few knots. If you're dissipating a lot of energy, that's not going to hurt you at all. Don't leave it clean when you push over. That's a big mistake. But if you have the option to add drag, go ahead and add drag and add speed, and you'll get even more energy benefit out of it. Because the energy cost is huge when you go fast with drag.
And the 180 handles this real well?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, the 150 is even more. The Cub is even, I mean, it's got 50-degree flaps. So if you fly it at the top of the wide arc mm-hmm. with no thrust and the nose down, the energy spin, the energy equation is all in your favor. You're just dissipating energy very quickly, which is your goal.
Right. Well, now that we've put our audience to sleep, let's talk about your worst airplane that you've ever flown and what the reason for that is.
I owned a Champ for a while, a 7GC. I think that's what it was. Champ was trying to make a Super Cub, and they made it heavy, and they didn't have much compliance in the gear. I bought one from a friend, and had it for a few years, and it wasn't a bad airplane, but...
just not exciting.
Yeah, it had a 135-horse motor in it.
Well, that's not bad for a Champ.
Yeah, it was a factory built. That was their 0290. That was not a conversion. It was built from
that's what it came out of the factory.
Yeah, right. And it was a bit heavy, but it worked okay.
Do you think it was the proverbial equation of too much engine for an airframe?
I think the airframe was quite a bit heavier than a 7GC, or a 7AC, I think it is, the standard Champ.
That's what Harvey's got.
Right. I wouldn't say it's fair to call it a bad airplane, but I was happy to build the Cub. But, you know, it's a little bit more like it fits on your...
Yeah. A Cub is... You fit into a Cub, and it's just it's an exciting flight, no matter what you do with it. Yeah.
The Champ had nice features. It was easier to get in and out of, and it had a real door and that kind of thing. But I've only owned, actually, I had an ultralight for a number of years from Phil Crepe, the guy who built the Winty. I bought a J3 Kitten.
Oh, I know exactly what that is.
Okay.
Yeah,
and I put 500 hours on that thing. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And you flew it out of your strip?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Had it for many years. I bought it from Phil, and he bought another J3 Kitten. That was an interesting airplane. It's a hard problem to make an airplane that flies okay at 20 miles an hour.
Right.
That's the control authority becomes a real question.
That's a real kite with an engine on it. That thing is very light.
Yeah. 250 pounds, and it had a...
not much of a crosswind component, I would imagine.
No, but you didn't need to. Right. You could always land it into the wind.
Right, because the rollout was 50 feet, right?
Yeah, you could fly it backwards. I did it a number of times, get on a windy day.
So if money wasn't an option or an obstacle, what would you go out and buy today if you had no obstacle in the money?
I don't think I would change much.
Really?
I'm not going to go win a stall contest, and I don't have any adrenaline. I don't like to spend that. I don't like a thrill. I like it to be smooth and easy and understandable and no surprises. So I would choose...
Stick with the 180, huh?
Yeah, the 180, and actually the Cub and the 150 they give so much pleasure. I can't tell you how much pleasure we've had out of the 150. I mean, it, for taking people for rides, and like you mentioned earlier, it's just...
And what do you burn an hour in that plane?
Oh, it's 6 gallons an hour. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but, an engine that is bulletproof
and
easy to repair. Parts are inexpensive, relatively, compared,
you know. I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. We've had a few nice flights. I haven't made very many long flights. We flew the 150 down to Concord, California, mm-hmm. one time to see a friend, and flew the 180 back to Nebraska, down to LA a few times. That's about it. Flew the Cub to Kitty Hawk.
Oh, wow.
That was fun. Yeah, that was 3 weeks, 80 days. 80 hours, three weeks of time, 80 hours of flying, 84, something like that. Yeah, didn't pass very many semis. right.
How often did you get stuck because of weather?
We were delayed maybe a day or two on the flight. I stopped at Oshkosh. My brother and I camped at Oshkosh to see that, and then we went museum hopping and had to go to Kitty Hawk to say we did it.
That's great adventure.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Yeah.
Did John ever take you up in the Ranger?
Yes, I did fly with Ken, actually.
Oh, really?
And then I think I've only had two flights in the Ranger, but it was a pleasure.
Oh.
It was wonderful. Wonderful.
I love that plane and the pattern. Yeah. I could just do pattern work all day long in that plane. It just settles so nice on the runway.
Yep. Oh, it's... And I like the access to get in and out. I don't have to struggle.
That big door.
It's wonderful.
No strut to worry about.
Right.
Yeah, roomy.
Yep.
You know, a guy my size, you know, I can suck the pedals up and this is cavernous thing, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like I could pack the house in the back of the airplane.
Have you camped in it? I've seen that option, but it looks like
I've never camped in it. I've done many hours in it.
I have a funny story for you. When I worked for Boeing, one of the people on the team, Otto Gelb, mm-hmm. an immigrant from, I don't know, Hungary or Czechoslovakia, he claimed, when he learned that I had a Luscombe, he said, well, you know, I worked for the Luscombe factory when I first came over after World War II. They were a struggling small company, and they didn't have enough money to do a drop test. They couldn't hire a crane to...
Oh, my God.
They had a requirement to drop it.
Right.
And he said, well, I'll fly that airplane to the FAA. I'm inventing some of this, but if I recall, he said, I'll fly it over a ribbon to your spec, and I'll drop it in. You make it as high as you like and tell me where you want me to drop it, and maybe that would qualify for the drop test. And they said, we'll work on that. And he did it. And he was involved in the engineering of the landing gear. And I think in the Luscombe there was a big change. I don't even remember. Ours had a steel strap from a single strut, a shock absorber in the center. I don't know whether that was the Silflex or the... But anyway, there was... And Otto Gelb was proud of the new design. And this was his contribution to the flying part of it, to do this little drop test. And thinking of your comment with Ken,
right?
You know, and Otto claimed that he met the FAA requirements by dropping that poor thing in from 10 feet. Or pick a number. I don't know the numbers.
Kind of
the same story.
It's quite a kidney punch when you do that, too.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, I had a landing like that out at Orcas the other day, but you know, every once in a while, you gotta prove that you can still land them wrong.
That's right. That's a good humble pie. That's good for all of us. Yes.
Well, hey, Rocky, before we kind of sign off here, I always like to ask my guests if they have anything of inspiration or advice for a younger generation. If you had a group of kids here who were aviation enthusiasts, what kind of advice would you give them?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't know how to give the cheerleader call today.
Well, it give seems, me some bullet points.
It seems so complicated to get the money together and to get a school with good continuity with instructors, and they're not moving on to the airlines. And I hear all these challenges. I don't know of any substitute besides wishing I was drawing airplanes when I was in elementary school. And,
right.
You know, my dad talked a little bit about flying a Jenny in the 20s, and it stuck. I never flew with him. He was too old and, you know.
And had sick, but.
But I guess to kindle that dream, the Young Eagles programs, the mentorship, build models. I don't have a strong model background for that. I didn't, you know, I built a few paper and balsa wood airplanes, but nothing mm-hmm. remarkable. I don't know how to get the kindling burning. I wish we could. It just seems like a daunting prospect.
I would think that a lot of the liability and litigation stuff mm-hmm. is something that is heavily considered today.
Right.
I remember as a kid driving by Harvey Field and my dad pulling over, and we just walked right out.
Yes, right. I hear you. Yeah, we used to land up on the mezzanine at SeaTac. You could watch the airplanes land. You know, that rooftop observation platform is gone. That's harder. That kind of thing makes it.
Yeah, what does it say to a kid when there's barbed wire fence around an airport? It says, "Stay away. This isn't for you."
Right.
You know, how do you get that message across?
Right.
And to Candace's credit at Harvey, you know, she's done a great job. The family there done a great job of giving an observation area.
Sure.
Anybody can walk out there and watch parachuters and balloons and airplanes landing, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure how many people know about it.
Right.
But here at Payne Field.
Oh, you're almost the enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There used to be a parking lot down at the south end here that mm-hmm. you could park and watch airplanes land and take off on the big runway. You can't do that anymore. It's all chained off.
Right. Yep. It's sort of the way our whole culture goes. It might be a risk. Therefore, close it,
yeah. Don't take a risk.
Right.
You know, we, again, here at Payne Field, now that there's commercial here, we used to do, Aviation Day here. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen anymore either.
Right. They used to have a big air show. I saw Bob Hoover do a wonderful act here.
Same here. I remember when Bob Hoover came.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was put on by the Rotary Club.
Yeah, right. And the SR-71. I went over and looked at it. Watched it take off on Monday morning. You know, that was cool.
Yeah. But when was the last time they had the air show here?
Right. Even Arlington, sad that. I don't know how to pass the torch. It's kind of self-centered to say, well, I've got mine. I'm not going to help out. I've never done a Young Eagles program. There was a benefit going at Monroe Airport a couple of years in a row mm-hmm. to help single moms and disadvantaged families. And then there was another one for mentally disabled people. There was a picnic at, do you know the Joe Heinick Farm north of Highway 2? It's an east-west strip.
Oh, yep.
Parallel
yep.
to the,
yep.
right. He's dead now, but when he was active,
right.
by retired Boeing engineer and a really nice guy. He had some benefit picnics there for disadvantaged families, and I donated flights to those events, small scale,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
10 flights.
But even donating your time, like a Young Eagles flight, the FAA won't let you take gas money.
Right, I recall reading that, right. It's, we're not happy till you're not happy.
And I'm like, this is anything that
mm-hmm.
you want to encourage.
Right. We have to keep this ball rolling.
Yeah.
We'll end up with pilots hired from the Middle East if we don't.
Instead, we get kids looking at game controllers and TV screens.
Right.
Because that's the easy access.
Right.
It's easier than going through a barbed wire fence.
Sure. Right.
So, and then
Well, I wish I knew the secret answer.
You know, and to pay some kudos to our friend John, you know, I know that he has it in his heart, a passion to bring that cost down.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he has done so much for the aviation world. We don't even realize how much that has helped. Right. It's going to be a decade before we look back and say, where's the another one?
Well, hey, Rocky, this has absolutely been wonderful. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming down and talking to me. Sort of a checkbox moment for me here.
Good.
I wish you and I could sit here all night and chat about airplanes and tell stories. But
let's fly a little bit together.
I would love it. I'd love to get a Rocky lesson going into his strip someday.
Anytime.
You bet.
I'll meet you at Harvey or here or whatever.
You got it.
I would enjoy it. Yeah.
Thanks, Rocky, for coming down.
My pleasure.
And now, chapter news for July 2022. This month's meeting will be held on Tuesday, July 12th, 7 p.m. at Harvey Field in Hangar 15. Our traditional pre-meeting burger burn will continue, starting at around 5:30. For a suggested donation of $5, you get a burger, chips, and soda. Just drop your money in the donation can or use PayPal and enjoy your meal. We don't want you to go hungry to the meeting, so get there early as we stop serving burgers well before the meeting starts, so you have plenty of time to help clean up and still make it to the meeting on time. Our guest speaker in July will be Zenith 750 pilot Dave Tillema. Dave is in the midst of a very unique adventure as he plans to land in all of the lower 48 states before Oshkosh this year. Dave will be video remote from somewhere on his travels, and will be ready to answer all of your questions about his trek, such as how he prepared for his flight and anything else members wish to ask him. Local big news is that Rainier Flight Services is taking over Northway Aviation located on Payne Field. According to a statement issued by owners Jim and Jill Grant, Northway closed its doors effective July 1st. Unfortunately, the statement also says that Rainier Flight Services will not transfer any of the Northway memberships, as they did not purchase Northway, but have signed a separate lease with Payne Field for a flight school at that location. Hopefully students will be able to transfer to Rainier without any additional costs, as we all know the price of a PPL or rating. We wish Jim and Jill happiness in their retirement and hope for Rainier's success in that location. Are you looking for an excuse to go fly? Then you need to learn about the Fly Washington Passport Program. The Fly Washington Passport Program encourages pilots and aviation enthusiasts to explore Washington's public use airports. Beyond motivating pilots to fly, this program supports general aviation airports, area businesses, tourism, and provides flight planning, safety, and educational opportunities. The program relies on the voluntary participation of Washington public use airports, pilots, aviation enthusiasts, and sponsors. The ultimate objective for this program is to increase aviation economic activity and enhance general aviation visibility. You can pick up a passport at most airport FBOs, including our own Harvey Field. This may be a great way to get together with fellow chapter members on a mission to fly somewhere. I'd love to hear that several members have come together to take on such an adventure and make a presentation to the chapter about it. And one last thing. Oshkosh. Air Venture starts Monday, July 25th. Goes through the week and ends on July 31st. If you plan on flying to Air Venture, please download the NOTAM, study it. It gets a little complicated at times with all the airplanes coming into the same airspace, and any kind of education you can give yourself before you find yourself behind the grid or behind the plane will help out. If you want some questions answered, please feel free to ask those who have flown into Oshkosh before. I'm sure that we would be happy to share our experiences. Keep in mind, we have a small contingency of EA Chapter 84s that will be camping at Oshkosh this year. If you're interested in meeting up with them, I suggest you look at social media such as Facebook or Instagram. I'm sure they'll be posting plenty of pictures on their adventures. Well, that wraps it up for this month's podcast. Spread the word about the EAA Chapter 84 podcast to your aviation friends and family. It's available for download on most popular apps, including Spotify, Apple, and Google. Make sure to hit that like button, subscribe, and give us a 5-star review. I hope to remember to file a flight plan for next month's podcast. Be sure to find the latest news by following EA Chapter 84 on social media apps like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll see you Tuesday evening. Save me a burger. Until next time, this has been your host, David Weber. And remember, stay off the brakes and keep moving forward.